Meeting to order, please. It's about 8 minutes after 11. Apologize for the late start. We did have another meeting in here that we were waiting to clear out, and some of us were in that other meeting and needed a little break in between. So we're off and running. I want to welcome you to the committee meeting on a wonderful, crisp Saturday morning. And some of you, I'm sure, expended less energy to get here. If you just held your coat out, the wind would blow you up the hill. You didn't have to walk. And appreciate you being here and taking your life in your hands to get here today. So we do have two bills before us today. We have House Bill 277, which is permanent absentee voting, and House Bill 287, which is a bill to deal with divesting investments in Sudan. I think we're going to start today with House Bill 277 that has to do with permanent absentee voting. I want to thank the committee members for showing up, and special thanks to our committee aide, and special thank you to those that are making sure that this gets streamed out over the airwaves and that we can make a record of what we're doing. So thank you all for participating. Committee members are here today are Reverend Johnson, Johansson, Coghill, and Dahl, and Vice Chair Roses. Representative Lynn spoke with him again. He is doing well. His wife is improving, and he is anticipating being back in the capital city on Monday if things continue to progress the way they are. So we'll be back to having more committee members. So with that, we will begin. So we're going to start with House Bill 277. So if the bill sponsor would like to come forward and give us a presentation, we're ready to hear.
We need to move this, yes.
Please. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to, for the purpose of a working document, move the CS for House Bill number 277, which is identified as 25-LS1095E Bullard.
Thank you very much. And your presentation is on the e-version, is that correct?
That is correct.
Thank you. Mr. Book, please state your name and please proceed.
Representative Bob Book, represented the slightly warmer district of South Anchorage today, the Banana Belt. Thank you, Chairman, and members of the committee for hearing this bill, and I really do appreciate everybody, including those online that have taken the time and trouble on a Saturday to come in and hear this bill. The bill before you would create a permanent absentee voting option for Alaskan voters. This means that for every election operated by the Division of Elections, an absentee ballot will automatically be sent to anyone who applies for permanent absentee voting status. Basically, the voter would not have to reapply for an absentee ballot for every election. They would only have to apply once and be done with it. The bill is designed to make voting more convenient for Alaskans, many of whom have seasonal jobs in the fishing and mining industries or on the North Slope. They will have the comfort of knowing that they will receive their ballot in the mail, can always vote, no matter where they are. In addition to making voting more convenient, House Bill 277 will streamline the absentee voting process for the Division of Elections by cutting down on paperwork and administrative costs. Permanent absentee voting is gaining popularity all over the country. Currently, 8 states allow the permanent absentee voting. There are 21 other states that have some version of it, whether it's no-excuse absentee balloting or mandatory vote-by-mail systems. Our proposal, however, is only for those people who choose it. Voters will still have the option of requesting a one-time absentee ballot if they so choose. Voters can also vote at their regular polling place if they wish. This bill doesn't make any changes to the statutes that govern absentee balloting except to provide for a permanent option. All the statutes and regulations that govern regular absentee ballots will govern permanent absentee ballots. This bill will apply only to state elections, not local ones. HB 277 will take effect 2009. It is supported by the Division of Elections, who is here to answer any questions you might have about the absentee process or what will be involved in implementing this option. The bill also has the support of the post office and the postal carriers, who are available via teleconference to make a statement. Finally, HB 277 has bipartisan support. I am joined by a team of Democrats and Republicans who have joined with me in sponsoring this legislation. Thank you for your time and attention. I urge your support, and we'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Any questions for the bill sponsor?
quick question.
Representative Johansson?
I'm just wondering, some states have voter by mail. I think Oregon does all their elections like that. I mean, is this, I guess, what the anticipation of a lot of people just doing functionally, what happens? They get a ballot. I've never voted absentee, so you get a ballot in the mailbox, you fill it out in your easy chair, and you put it back in the mail, and it goes back. Is that how it goes?
That's correct. You can do that currently. Anybody can do that. Some people in primary states, as a matter of fact, could have done this in that caucus. I know that my staff did that. She voted absentee in New Jersey for this last election, this last caucus that we had just last Tuesday. So they make it available for all of the options statewide.
Why didn't you just do a mail-in ballot system? Is there a...
Well, we don't have one here in the state. In some states, they have, like you said, gone to that, and it's been very successful. Some states are moving in that direction. This, by increment, gives us an opportunity to look at this system and see if it's something that we would approve of and will work here. And so, slowly, by giving voters options, we may eventually get there. I don't know. That's going to be the choice of the system, the voters, the public.
And the legislature, I guess, at some point.
Absolutely.
Just curious if we're inching towards that sort of a system. Maybe.
This is just another option.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Dahl.
Thank you for bringing this forward. I think it's an important one. And you and I have already talked about this a little bit, but I'm also saying this for the benefit of those who ask the same questions as I have in the past. Looking at your the information inside the booklet, it says here, when fraud is found, however, absentee balloting is often implicated. And then it talks about it takes four forms, forging signatures, coercing, influencing a vote buying, and misapportionment of misappropriating absentee ballots. Could you, I think there, have you found anything that would say that that would counteract that and say that it's really not a problem or it is a problem? Just what is the evidence showing on this?
Through the chair, Representative Dahl, there is testimony to that effect by those people who caretake for those security issues, and I would welcome their testimony. The postal workers are online, as well as the Division of Elections Director is here. So those are the people with the expertise.
That's fine. I'll wait.
Any other questions from committee members? I have one. What kind of safeguards are put in place to prevent someone, let's say, for example, an absentee ballot is mailed out. They either don't get it for some reason, you know, maybe they've changed addresses and they forgot to record it or it's forwarded or whatever reason they don't get it in a timely fashion. They happen to be in town, and so they go to their polling place and they vote, and then shortly after that, the absentee ballot comes in the mail. What happens? Or say they get it and mail it in early, and they forget that they've done it, and then they go to the polls. What kind of safeguards are in place to ensure that someone votes once and not more than once?
Chair Roses, we have those security in place now through the Division of Elections. They do verify votes so that if there is duplicity, they caretake for that. But the exact procedure I'm not familiar with, and we can get that for you. I'm sure the director's here, and she could testify to that. But this doesn't preclude you from those other options. You can still do that. You can still vote at your regular polling place. You can vote early. You can vote in front of a registrar, absentee early. So those other options are not precluded because of this option.
If you have a permanent absentee process, so that way you don't have to apply every year, it automatically gets sent to you. If you happen to take one of those other options and you go to the poll and vote, does that mean that you now have to reapply for the permanent? Is it automatic? You're still going to get it even though you voted in your precinct?
According to the statutes in this bill, no, sir. If there's anybody that would like to comment to the
I will have
contrary, then I would like to have them testify to that as well, just to verify that.
Thank you. I'm going to go to the director here in a minute and let them have testimony, and they can answer any questions that... Right. or correct anything that we've said. So thank you. Any other questions from any committee members?
Thank you very much.
Stay where you are. You may have some other questions. Okay. So at this point, I'm going to go to the director for the Division of Elections. Gail, are you there?
Yeah.
Oh, you're in the audience. Thank you. Please state your name and please proceed.
Gail Finumiai, Director, Division of Elections. I'm here today to let the committee know, thank you, Vice Chair, and committee members, that the division is supportive of HB 277. And there is no fiscal impact on the division for implementing this new process. We have a very strong absentee by mail program now. In the 2004 election, over 71,000 people voted in one form of absentee voting or another. And I believe we processed over 50,000 by mail applications during the 2004 presidential election. So I'm here to answer any questions you have. You have some specific questions about voting in person. And
after you, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, go ahead, please. Representative Coghill.
One of the things that absentee voting always gets us on is how well our list is formulated, the integrity of it. Do we have good mailing addresses? And so what was your return rate on our present absentee voting? I know that right now they apply, and you probably have a very good address because they're making an application. Once we get into this situation, we're going to run into, I think, another problem. So, but how do we have many returns now from even those that apply?
Vice Chair, Representative Coghill, I don't have statistics on that information on, like, how many people apply and the ballot. We may send their ballot and it may come back undeliverable. I'm sure it happens. I don't think it's in huge quantities. I believe the way the bill is drafted, that if we mail a ballot to a voter who wants to be a permanent absentee voter and it comes back undeliverable, we would cease mailing any future ballots to that voter until they notify us at their ballot of a different ballot mailing address.
It would be interesting to me to find out what our error rate is on those who actually apply and give their best mailing address, because the federal requirements on how we can purge our voter list and how well we maintain our list are almost going to be essential then if we go into this permanent absentee voting. So then I guess the next question I would have is the credentialing. Have we run into trouble credentialing those who absentee vote now? And would this create another problem of knowing for sure that that person is who they say they are when they fill out an absentee vote? Is the credentialing going to change, I guess?
Vice Chair Roses, please. And Representative Coghill, the process wouldn't change now. When somebody applies to vote by mail, they have to provide some form of identification on their by mail application, such as the last four digits of the Social Security number, date of birth, their driver's license, state ID number. And they sign an oath saying they are who they say they are. And when they vote that by-mail ballot, it has to be witnessed by somebody who is authenticating that that person really is the person who's signing the oath and affidavit on the back of that envelope.
Mr. Chairman, as we go down this road, we're going to be asking a question: how can you scam this system? I think that's what I'm going to have to watch out for. And so I'm going to listen really intently. I like the idea, but even in our open voting and in our absentee voting, we're self-identifying, and the whole Social Security number thing, where somebody can co-opt somebody else's identity, starts getting, when you can get somebody to verify that that is in fact your signature, we don't really have the capacity to check it. But when you go into vote, they look at you, look at your driver's license, and see that there is some similarity. Once we get into the paper world, it's a little different credentialing. And so maybe there is some answer. I see he's got his raised hand, but how we scan the system is something that I'm going to have to watch out for.
Representative Book, do you want to respond to that?
I did, Vice Chair. Representative Coghill, I believe there's some testimony. This isn't the first time this has been put in effect. There is some history on this, and we do have some people who would testify this online. So that is my concern with putting legislature forth like this, is that the possibility of gaming. Am I enhancing this? Am I giving the opportunity? to give somebody an availability of creating fraud is a huge concern of mine, too. So I don't want my name on it either. I appreciate your consideration.
Okay, and the question, did you want to follow up? Or?
It's just that maybe the director can talk about how they check the absentee voting now. You have the self-identification. Is our cross-check system already in place that we're going to use when we go into this?
Vice Chair Roses, Representative Coghill. The same procedures that we use now for if you were to just apply annually for to vote by mail would be the same procedures we will use for somebody who's a permanent absentee voter. They would fill out an application, provide an identifier, sign an oath saying they are who they are. There are statutes, on the books for voter fraud, election offenses, people who would perhaps try to commit that kind of an offense saying they were somebody else, and if it was later, there are penalties for that.
And Mr. Chairman, just a comment, because your list that you have, I can take it right, I can buy a list for my district from you for $20, I think, or $22. I can put it on my machine, print labels to mail out to everybody in that district, and I would guess 30% of them return undeliverable. So it just creates a problem for me. I'm just thinking out loud here.
Vice Chair Roses, Representative Coghill. But the onus would be on the voter to provide an updated mailing address, which the division then would, if it was a new permanent mailing address, the division then would correct that on the voter registration rolls as well. Because the absentee by mail application serves a dual purpose. It's also an initial registration form, and it can be used to update anything on a current voter's registration record.
Good point.
The order for questions is Representative Dahl, Johnson, and Johansson. So Representative Dahl, go ahead.
Quite a few questions. How long does it take to do a cross-check, particularly out of state, if someone decides that they can, in fact, vote before they leave state, and then they go down, and then the absentee ballot does show up down there in San Diego or wherever, and they, well, what the heck, can they do it again? How long does it take you all to cover that and cross-check that?
Through the chair, Representative Dahl. If you apply to vote by mail and for some reason under that example you decide, well, I'm going to be here election day after all,
mm-hmm.
or I think that's what you're asking, is that correct? Okay. If you were here election day and you go to the polls, you sign a precinct register, and then the division after election day enters in voter history from every person who signed that precinct register, mm-hmm. and their voter record is flagged that they voted in person at the polls on election day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in your scenario, if the voter went back to San Diego, say, and their ballot was there and they tried to mail it, well, first of all, it would be postmarked after Election Day and we wouldn't count it.
Or they did early voting, say.
Or they did early voting.
Whatever.
Mm-hmm. The same, we would have it in the system already that they voted early, absentee in person, say, before they left town. They still got their ballot and mailed it back. When we review those ballots, they would note in the system that they had already voted early and that ballot then would not be counted.
I see. And could you speak a little bit to the military ballot, how this would work for those in the military who are changing bases and so forth, going from one spot to another? Would this be a real problem in sending them a permanent absentee ballot?
Through the Vice Chair, Representative Dahl. Currently, military and overseas citizens have the option to apply to vote by mail and have a ballot sent to them for the next two general elections. So I believe that law changed in 2006. The onus is still on the voter to let us know that they have a new ballot mailing address. This would be a further extension of that, and it would put them on as a permanent absentee voter indefinitely. But the onus is on the voter to let us know that they've changed their ballot mailing address. I'm not really sure how we at the Division of Elections could simplify that process and make it easier on them to let us know. The voter does have to let us know.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You said you had 71,000 people vote. Was that the last election by absentee? I want to make sure. Was it 71,000?
Vice Chair, Representative Johnson, 71,000 people voted in one form of absentee voting. I believe it was in the 2004 presidential election.
And do you have any numbers, through the chair, do you have any numbers on how many were sent out?
I, Vice Chair and Representative Johnson, I don't at this time, but I can get that for you if you'd like that.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to know that. I mean, is it a high percentage? Is it a low percentage? Is it 50%? Is it 100%? The other question I have is on a different subject. How hard is it to take someone off of the voter list, the voter registration list? What's the procedure for, what do we have to do to get someone off the voter list?
Through the Vice Chair, Representative Johnson, I recently returned to the division after being gone for 5 years, and I don't have the list maintenance process memorized at this point. I believe it is something like if the voter does not contact, vote, make an attempt to vote in any form in two election cycles, that they are then put on notification that they will be removed from the rolls. I would definitely be able to get you some information later today if you would like detailed on that.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I'd like to see that because I thought it was much more difficult than that. Just if you just don't vote in two election cycles, was that a 4-year or 8-year or 2-year?
Vice Chair Rose's representative, I believe it's a 4-year cycle. I would like to look at the statute in a little more detail and get you that information if that would be fine.
Yeah, that is a question I have because once, Mr. Chair, that once these people are on, I mean, the title does say permanent. And is there any provision that if someone fails to vote by absentee, that they're taken off the list in this bill? I mean, if you're on this permanent vote and then you don't send it in, so would that mean that if they fail to do that two times, they come off of this list?
Vice Chair Rose's Representative Johnson, I don't believe so because they've maintained a form of contact by indicating they wanted to be a permanent absentee voter. That would be my interpretation of it, but I think we might have to get legal to look at that.
So if I understood your answer, so if I apply once, then I can't ever be taken off the roll because I've made a contact to be a permanent voter?
I would have to look through the Vice Chair. I would have to look at the list maintenance laws a little more closely to be able to determine that and maybe consult with Representative Book might want to consult with legislative legal on that issue as well.
With the permission to please. Just express a concern, you know, it seems like every election cycle, it's woe is me, we have a 30% voter turnout or we have a 20% voter turnout. My district happens to be very good, and I think I'm in the high to mid-50s, but there are places where we have very low voter turnout. If people aren't voting is one thing, that's a different problem than if we have an inaccurate list. And if we start adding people to a list that can never be taken off, I have serious problems with, you know, because eventually we're going to be at a 10% voter turnout and everyone in your district may have voted. There's going to come a point where it's just not going to function well for us to know what we're doing as a democracy. So I want to look at that very closely to see, I mean, if you're permanently on a list, that's a problem for me.
Vice Chair Roses and Representative Johnson, Representative Bookstaff happen to have the list maintenance statutes handy right here if you'd like me to read this from you to you, or would you like me to put something in writing to the committee on this?
Go ahead and read it. Okay. It's up to the time of the chairman.
Sure. It says that annually the division conducts list maintenance and examines the master register, requesting address confirmation or correction to each voter whose mail from the division has been returned to the division in the 2 years immediately preceding examining the list. A voter who has not contacted the division in the 2 years immediately preceding the examination of the list, and those who have not voted or appeared to vote in the two general elections immediately preceding the examination of the list. And then I believe it's a two-step process on receiving notification, and then if they don't respond to those notices, they are kept on the list for period of time ending the last day of the fourth calendar year after the date the last notice went, and then they're inactivated, but they aren't actually removed from the rolls until that fourth year. They're put on an inactive list, which is, I believe those voters do not appear then on the voter list that you purchase as a representative, because the list you see, I believe, is those only of active voters.
So, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, this isn't really a permanent, contrary to the title, this isn't permanent. If someone signs up for it, fails to vote, they're registered, they fail to vote in, I guess it would be two presidential election cycles, then they're removed from the list and no longer get a ballot.
Vice Chair Rose, Representative Johnson, it appears that there would, the voter would also, though, receive multiple notices from the division advising them that if they don't make contact, vote, update their voter registration record, that they would be dropped, yes.
I have to stew on that a little bit.
Representative Johansson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You may have answered this already. What is the level of absentee voting percentage-wise just in the last couple elections?
Vice Chair Rose, Representative Johansson, I don't have those statistics handy. Just the numbers of people who applied to vote by mail in 2004 was around 50,000. I don't know what the return rate and what that overall percentage equates as those who vote in person at the polling place. I could get that information for the committee if you would like.
Well, please, go ahead.
Just in reading the backup, it has some statistics as far as the state of Washington at 90%, California 50%, New Mexico 40%. So what I'm trying to figure out is how much do we do now and what sort of impact this has on the total number of absentee folks. I mean, you know, if we're at 20%, if we're going to jump to 80%, that is a huge switch in the way people vote, and that leads to concern about the questions that both of my colleagues have brought up about the process of knowing who's on that list and the security of all of that. So I'd be curious to know what those numbers are. And also, have you looked at, it looked like they had eight states that were listed that have, and I may be reading this wrong, there's a list that the sponsor had in the backup. Have you looked at the other states and how they handle the questions that the rules chairman and the resources chairman have been putting out there?
Vice Chair Rose, Representative Johansson, no, I have not. I have not seen that list of other states, but would definitely look into it and see how they handle this type of thing.
If I may, I think if we're going to put it, something in like this that has a very large increase in the way people vote, I would hope before and probably need to have to make me feel better before I could support this when it gets to the floor, is to understand how other states that have very high levels of doing this method that you guys aren't basically trying to figure it out on your own. I mean, I'd like to compare it to other states, et cetera.
Representative Brook, you want to respond?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Rep. Johansson, I believe there is testimony to this in this regard from the Postal Service, who has had records and has had some of the numbers you're looking for and can respond to these, and they are online waiting to answer.
And I'm going to them as soon as we're through with the committee questions.
Vice Chair Rose, Representative Johansson, I'm not sure if the eight states, are they permanent by-mail states? I mean, is it by-mail voting only? Because this still would be, the voter would have to take the initiative to fill out the application. It's different from having all by-mail elections. So I'm not sure if the eight states on that list, I know Oregon is an all by mail, there's no option. I mean, you vote by mail, everybody gets mailed a ballot. This still, the process just would make it so a voter doesn't have to apply annually every year on January 1st.
Chairman, Representative Johansson?
I believe this is in Project Vote, permanent no-fault absentee, and I don't know the details of the definitions and how you qualify to be that.
Mm-hmm.
But my broad point is I would like you guys to look at how other states do it to try and solve some of the questions that these two have asked you. And I'd also like to find out what sort of a bump we may expect, how much we do now by mail. How much, obviously you can't predict, but if it's going to be a big increase, I need to feel comfortable that, and I understand the Postal Service is going to testify, but I would like to have an analysis of how the official state elections in other states handle this and just to feel comfortable with these questions that these two have been asking. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions from the committee members?
Mr. Chairman, if I could.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I want to go back to, you know, the voter rolls. So it's my understanding that according to what you told me, every 4 years we would be purging those people who hadn't voted in the previous two elections. Can you give me a number of how many people we actually took off the voter rolls in the last, would be the last presidential cycle and the one before that?
The Vice Chair Rose's, Representative Johnson, I don't have that number handy, but I can get that.
I didn't expect you to, okay. But I would certainly like to know how many we took off.
So you would like to know those who were actually deleted from the rolls?
Yes,
okay.
Ma'am.
Any further questions from the committee members?
Could I make a final comment, sir?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you for your indulgence, Vice Chair. The hope of the other states was that this would improve voter participation. In Oregon, which is the only state that has vote by mail currently, they do have a very, very high turnout of elections because everybody gets a ballot, everybody votes. And they have had, in the occurrence of the last presidential election, close to 80%, which is huge. Now, this process here hasn't had the same kind of response. And even though it gave a certain level of convenience and added that, they have not seen the increments, even though that was the hope. So being realistic with this, I also have to report what's in your packet, that it doesn't testify to that fact, that it has increased the participation to the extent that people had wished. So.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Just one more. On the fiscal note, so it's not, there will be no impact on mailing an additional 3,000 ballots out, or however many it happens to be, hopefully a lot, and it works. So you're saying that it will cost no more to do this project than what you're doing now?
Vice Chair Rose's, Representative Johnson, perhaps the fiscal note should have been an indeterminate fiscal note. I mean, I think it's rather difficult to predict how many people might actually take advantage of this. Many of these people may be those who apply and vote every year anyway. It's very difficult to gauge, I believe, how much this will increase the by-mail voting program.
Thank you, Mr. I do see that it has a finance referral, so.
Thank you. Any further questions from the committee members? Seeing none, I am going to go online to the Anchorage, to Larry Benson. Larry, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Did you want to make some comments on this bill?
Yes, I do.
Please state your name and affiliation and proceed.
Okay, my name is Larry Benson. I'm the president of the American Postal Workers Union, of course, representing the American Postal Workers Union. There's been a lot of talk about registering, et cetera, but I'll go over what I've got on my mind here. As you know, Alaskans now may register absentee vote now. However, it isn't permanent. However, once a voter registers as a permanent absentee voter, state election ballots would be sent to the homes of those voters indefinitely. House Bill 277 does have safeguards built into that law that would require permanent absentee voters to vote in every election. That was my understanding, that when a permanent absentee voter fails to vote in any election, either absentee or at the poll, that voter's name would be removed from the permanent absentee rolls and would no longer receive a ballot in the mail in the future. However, the bill also allows a permanent absentee voter who has been removed from the permanent absentee voter rolls to re-register so that they would again receive a permanent absentee ballot in the mail. Permanent absentee ballots would not be forwarded to a voter's new address in the case that a voter moving to a new home location. The Postal Service would return those ballots to the Division of Elections for final determination. Again, a voter, after moving, would be able to re-register with the new address for permanent absentee voter status. And that would give you the ability at the Division of Elections to clean up the voter rolls. Security of ballots. You know, the security and the safeguarding of state election ballots is really the highest of priorities. And while the Postal Service would be the means for the delivery of the ballots to a permanent absentee voter, the Postal Inspection Service, and the Office of the Inspector General are the law enforcement divisions within the Postal Service. And both agencies do have a high conviction rates related to all criminal mail matters. On-time delivery. The Postal Service is a professional delivery service with over 200 years of experience in sortations and the delivery of the mail. And the service has no problems with high volumes of first-class mail that must be processed within a deadline. For example, on April 15th of each year, federal income taxes are due, and the service recognizing first-class mail to the Internal Revenue Service isolates and processes all of that mail in one night's operations to meet the 2,400-hour deadline for filing. The Postal Service is committed to the on-time delivery of the mail, and at present has an on-time delivery rating in Alaska of 96.15%. As far as voter turnout goes, as seen in the state of Oregon, where vote-by-mail has been enacted and where voter turnout has increased, vote-by-mail has an 81% approval rating. Permanent absentee vote-by-mail in Alaska will increase voter turnout. And as the Division of Elections have said, it's hard to gauge what that would be, but we believe it will increase voter turnout. In Alaska, absentee vote will be beneficial to many of the state citizens who work in areas away from the polls, working parents, the elderly, the disabled, and those who just prefer to vote by mail will see an increase. When it comes to costs, I know the state of Washington, California, Oregon, to name a few, report a savings in the cost of elections with vote by mail. And likewise, the state of Alaska will also save in the cost of elections. When it comes to procedural integrity, I'm sure that's on the minds of us all. And permanent absentee vote by mail will provide greater procedural integrity. Vote by mail will provide a paper trail for each vote cast, unlike electronic voting machines. And those machines are susceptible to computer hackers, and, you know, they don't have those safeguards. However, vote-by-mail has shown no increase in voter registration fraud despite 19 different states having used it in at least one election. It's nonpartisan. There are no reports that indicate the permanent absentee vote-by-mail has any direct or indirect effect on partisan composition of the electorate. The benefits to the voters. Receiving a ballot in the mail 2 weeks before an election, you know, that reminds the voter that the election is imminent. And permanent absentee vote by mail will allow voters to research candidates and issues and vote at their convenience. Permanent absentee vote by mail will eliminate decisions within the voting booth. So the American Postal Workers Union brings this bill forward to ensure that all Alaskans have equal access to voting. And for all the reasons I presented here, I ask you for your support of passing House Bill 277, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions for Larry Benson from any committee members?
Right.
Representative Dahl.
Could you remind me the time lapse? If someone moves permanently out of state but doesn't notify and they continue to get an absentee ballot, and I'm sure that we catch up sooner or later, but what is the time length between checking on that? I know it was brought up a few minutes ago, but could you remind me again what that would be to catch up with that ballot?
Okay, you're asking that if a voter moves out of state,
right?
How long?
No longer a resident of Alaska, but receives an absentee vote ballot.
And you want to know how long before that ballot would get back to the Division of Elections?
And then caught up in terms of someone saying, you know what, he doesn't even live in the state anymore. How long would that take before that would happen?
You know, it might take 3, 4, 5 days at the most. It just, as soon as we get it, we would, if they've moved out of state and they have a forward on file, which a forward lasts for 1 year, but we would not forward a ballot. That ballot, I'm sure the Division of Elections can answer this question. It would say not to forward it, return address correction requested. Did I answer your question?
Yes, and I think you'll probably reply here as well, right?
Please.
Vice Chair, Representative Dahl. The outgoing envelope that a by-mail ballot is sent in, it says it is not forwardable, to not be forwarded by the U.S. Postal Service, so they are not forwarded.
Thank you. Any other questions for Larry? Seeing none, thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Vice Chair Roses, and all of you on the committee.
Okay, thank you. We're going to go to Dorsey Rowland. Dorsey, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Please state your name and affiliation and proceed with the testimony.
Hi, my name is Dorsey Rowland. I'm with the National Association of Letter Carriers. Just like to say thanks for the opportunity to speak on behalf of this bill. I had something prepared, but I guess it's changed a little bit based on what I've heard from the committee. There's been some concerns on how House Bill 277 is going to function. Currently, we have in process a system that allows us somebody to vote by absentee mail. Basically, the change that is being made is simply to allow a person to have the option of being, you know, once they register, to receive their ballot permanently. Now, my expectation when we started forwarding this is somebody like me who uses absentee ballot does it on a continual basis, and it just provides an ease for the voter, to not have to re-register every year, and it cuts down on some of the paperwork that the Division of Elections would have to do by processing those ballots every single year. If you get somebody that's voting all the time and does it by absentee ballot, then, you know, they register once and they don't have to register again. I do want to say that one of the absentee ballots, one of the concerns that was raised is, you know, how do we verify what they are, you know, that's indeed my ballot. And when you provide your application to the Division of Elections, you provide proof of your identity, and it's also verified by your signature. When your ballot's mailed into the Division of Elections, it's verified by your signature. And by doing that, that does create a paper trail that is verifiable, and it definitely doesn't produce any missing ballots. I know that Oregon keeps getting brought up, but, you know, they've pretty well got a vote-by-mail system, which this really isn't, but they haven't had any instances of fraud in Oregon. One of the unexpected results that has happened by the vote-by-mail that was a concern raised by the committee is that it's actually assisted the Division of Elections in purging their list so that you get a truer figure of the percentages of your voter turnout in the elections. And I'll quite honestly tell you, I can't explain right now how that happened, but if you're interested in finding out, I could track that information down for you. And my support comes from the, you know, I'm one of the people that sit and look at, you know, we have, if we indeed had a statewide 50% turnout, that would be outstanding. But I look at the elections and we have low voter turnout, and I just look at this as a way to promote voting and hopefully getting more people involved in voting and supporting the process. You know, it supports both sides and hopefully will increase our voting in the future.
Thank you, Dorsey. Any questions for Dorsey from the committee? Representative Johansson?
Yeah, I'm just curious. I agree with you that, and the sponsor, do whatever we can to get as many people involved. I guess this might not be for Dorsey, but I'm just wondering how the postal workers, they seem to be testifying on the functions of the Division of Elections, and I'm just curious, other than the logistical challenges of getting mail back and forth, I'm just curious as to, is that a hobby for you guys, election law, or?
Well, No, it's definitely an interest, and it's something that a good friend of mine named Kevin Card was very involved in. He's a carrier in Branch 86 in Portland, Oregon, who were instrumental in getting the vote by mail laws passed in Oregon State. So I had opportunity to sit down and talk with him at length about vote by mail. So I dabbled a little of it, but I certainly am not an expert on the law.
If I may,
please,
Mr. Chairman, I certainly give you kudos to being an active citizen in our government. Good on you for learning about how the regulations work.
Thank you. Any other questions for Dorsey?
Maybe I should.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dorsey, can you tell me how much more mail, in terms of volume, has Oregon gotten through your system or through the Postal Service since the vote by mail started during that period? Is it a 10% increase, a 40% increase?
It's been a percentage-wise. I'll put a close estimate on it. I guess it shows a bias on our part that, you know, we want to participate in this system, but it has generated a revenue increase for the Postal Service of about, I believe it was $450,000 in revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions for Dorsey? Seeing none, thank you both for testifying, and we appreciate it. Anyone in the audience wishing to testify on House Bill 277? Seeing none, I have no one else online, do I? Okay, I'm going to close public testimony on House Bill 277. Any further comments or questions by the committee members? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's on page 2, line 23. It says that basically what qualifies for absentee voting, basically state, general, special elections, other elections for which the state is responsible. Can you outline the other elections that the state is responsible for?
Vice Chair, Representative Johnson, those would be the unincorporated areas of the state where we conduct the school board elections, the regional educational attendance area elections. We also conduct local liquor option elections, dissolution elections, incorporation elections on behalf of the local boundary commission for various communities. For all communities. We did one in Ketchikan a while back. We're getting ready to do an incorporation election in Wrangell right now. So there are a variety of smaller elections that we do.
So continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So let me pose a hypothetical. If I'm a voter and I want to sign up for permanent status on absentee voting, I will not be getting a municipal ballot through the mail to vote absentee all the time?
Vice Chair, Representative Johnson, that's correct. That would be responsibility of the local municipality to adjust their local ordinances to allow this to happen. This would just affect state-conducted elections.
Continue.
So is there any way, is there any desire that we could just maybe have one voting system instead of two? You start touting this as a permanent voting, absentee voting. I, for one, if I read that and said, oh, great, now I can do it, I'm going to be very disappointed when I don't get my municipal ballot.
Vice Chair Rose, Representative Johnson, I believe then it would be, you know, the responsibility of the division to make it clear to voters this is only for state elections. It does say on our absentee ballot that it is for, that if they want to vote for city and borough elections, they have to apply directly with the city borough clerk's office.
Mr. Chairman,
go ahead, Representative Johnson.
I think I admire the goal of this, but I think maybe what we've done is excluded a certain number of people who may think they're getting a permanent ballot because now we're setting up two voting systems. And right now we have a fairly consistent way of doing absentee ballots. The municipality is fairly consistent. The state's fairly consistent, and now we're one of the two's kind of going down a different road. And I see this as a potential disenfranchisement of people who may think they're signing up for a full-time absentee ballot, and all of a sudden their ballot doesn't show up for a municipal election or a school board or whatever it happens to be. So I don't know. I encourage the sponsor to know what your intention is on this bill today. but I encourage the sponsor to see if there's not a way we can have a unified election process where we're not dealing with, oh, I've got to do my election this time I don't, and place that confusion in the voter's head, because if what we want to do is ease of election, I'm not sure we've done it unless we do everything the same.
Vice Chair Rose, is Representative Johnson. The current system requires people to still apply separately for all local elections, locally conducted elections. So although they would be checking a box and they want to be a permanent absentee voter, I would still have to apply to vote by mail for my local election if I wasn't going to be in town. Voters, I think, are used to having to apply separately for their municipal elections. I'm not sure if this would really, truly have that much of a negative impact on the current process.
Continue.
2 points, Mr. Chair. The I'm not sure part causes me some concern, because neither am I, and I would like to be sure. Secondly, do you maintain the voter? Does the municipality maintain its own voter list?
Vice Chair Rose's, Representative Johnson, they use the state voter registration list as their list, but they don't. Our absentee voting list is only applicable to state elections. We don't share that with the municipality. They maintain their own list of those people who want to vote absentee by mail.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? Representative Dahl?
Just conclusion. Please. For myself, even though I have many concerns about fraud and duplication and all kinds of things, worries, still the thought of being able to bring more people to vote is a very strong argument. And Election Day, there's many, many people not coming to the right polling place. So they're concerned about this, that. They can't get there. And if we can increase the numbers, and particularly seniors and those who aren't able to travel, this would be a wonderful thing. And I am thinking that the problems will be sorted out. It may not be sorted out right away. And, of course, when sometimes votes are very close, this is a great concern. You don't want to wait years to have something sorted out. But on the other hand, the possibility of improving the system is a great one for me, so I would support this.
Representative Book, you have
Could
a comment?
I conclude? Yes.
Please.
In presenting this bill and offering this up through the people that actually came forward with me to me with this bill was to provide another option, not to change the system, but as an adjunct to that, to make for an ease and convenience, and certainly not to enhance any ability for fraud or to increase any opportunities for any other gaming of the system. So in looking at this bill carefully, I really appreciate all the comments and certainly am at the will of the chair and of the committee, and I really appreciate your support. And like I said earlier, thank you for taking the time and trouble to have this committee meeting on this.
Any other comments from the committee members? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I like the concept of increasing voter participation. I'm concerned that we're setting up a different system than the municipalities have. And the reality is that, I don't know, 80% of the population of the state lives inside boroughs we will not be dealing, this piece of legislation will be dealing in, that we're setting up a separate and yet parallel system that's going to be confusing. I'm not sure the end result is not going to be that we disenfranchise voters in those municipal elections, because they also suffer the same consequences of voter turnout, et cetera. So I have concerns about this bill. I still have some questions that need to be answered. I'm not sure my comfort level is there quite yet with this piece of legislation.
Any other committee comments? Seeing none, is there a motion? Representative Dahl?
Get to my yes, I would like, I make a motion to move this bill. CS for House Bill 277/25/LS1095/E.
With individual recommendations and any fiscal note?
And with the fiscal note.
Thank you. Any opposition to moving the bill? Seeing none, CS for House Bill number 277 has passed out of the State Affairs Committee, and we will take a brief at ease while we sign the roster, and then we're immediately going to start with House Bill 287. So it'll take about maybe a minute, 2 minutes. Committee, please. We're going to start talking about House Bill 287. We have quite a number of people that are here to testify. We have quite a number of people online wanting to testify. So when we do go to public testimony, I would appreciate it very much if you'd keep your comments precise and brief and to the point. See if we can try to keep this down to 3 minutes per person, if possible. And except for the presenter of the bill, of course, you have a little more time than that. But otherwise, we are never going to get through this. So with that being said, we Representative Coghill did have to step out of the meeting. He will be back. He's got three meetings that are going simultaneously. So talk about split personality. Wow. Here we go. House Bill 287. Did you want to present the bill to us, please?
For the record, my name is Dirk Moffitt, staff to Representative Lynn. Honorable Chair and honorable members of the State Affairs Committee, thank you for hearing HB 287, an act relating to certain investments of Alaska Permanent Fund, the State Retirement System, the State of Alaska Supplemental Annuity Plan, and a deferred compensation program for the state's employees and companies that do business in Sudan, and restricting those investments, or the short title, Divest Investments in Sudan. Honorable Chair and honorable members of the State Affairs Committee, Alaska should not invest in companies that have a business relationship and are complicit with the Sudanese government's policy of genocide in Darfur, the western region of Sudan. More than 400,000 people have been killed. An additional 2.5 million have been forced from their homes, and untold thousands of women and children have been raped and abducted since Sudan began sponsoring attacks on innocent civilians in Darfur. On July 22nd, the U.S. Congress declared that the atrocities unfolding in Darfur are, in fact, genocide. This is the first time the United States government has recognized genocide while it's still occurring. HB 287 mandates target divestment and prohibits future investment of the state-managed PFD and pension funds in targeted companies that do business in Sudan. The overall objective of this legislation is to pressure Sudan economically until it ends its genocide in Darfur. The state of Alaska can do this with slim to no impact on our fund manager's wise investment mandate to invest principal while maximizing total returns. Alaska has very little invested in Sudan, about $22 million, or 0.06% of the total assets. And it's important to note that none of the targeted companies currently operating in Sudan are American. U.S. Senator Sam Brownback said, former Republican presidential candidate, "We've said often enough, never again, and taken up the pledge of not on our watch. We also need to take up the pledge of not on our dime." To date, over 20 states have passed legislation to divest assets from companies doing business with the government of Sudan. Alaska is the 49th state to join the union, but it should not be the last to say no to genocide, not on our dime. And with that, I thank you, and I would appreciate your support of HB 287.
Any committee members have questions for the bill sponsor? Representative Johansson?
Of the 20 states that have divested, do they have a similar entity as the Permanent Fund Corporation?
To my knowledge, no.
And
continue.
Unless Representative Johnson has a question for Dirk.
I'd wonder if the co-prime sponsor would come up and comment on a policy question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Representative Johansson, did you want our position on the bill or an answer to your question?
I had a specific question for one of the co-primes. In some of the research before this meeting started, I noticed on the Genocide Intervention Network's website, which I've noticed is also part of your backup of supporting this bill, that there were eight
separate areas that were identified by that organization as being trouble spots or hot spots or however you want to characterize it. Iraq, Burma, Sri Lanka, Somalia, Kenya, Congo, Central African Republic, Chad, were all listed. I'm wondering, I guess, one, why would we single out, and I understand the atrocities, there's no argument there, and I think we're all on the same page about how horrible the conditions are, but why are these eight not being addressed, and we're putting one single country into statute? Have you considered legislation that would guide the investment policy overall rather than specifically pick out countries?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are certainly a number of things you could do to regulate our investment managers. There are a lot of kinds of companies that one member or another member might find objectionable, maybe tobacco companies. And then you go to the further level of companies that commit atrocities, and there are companies across the world that commit atrocities. But there's no atrocity worse than genocide. Genocide is the killing of innocent people who are unarmed. And the United States Congress, the President of the United States, have determined that what is going on in Darfur is genocide. You know, I once heard a comment by a politician that we shouldn't act until there's enough proof of genocide, and that was was their comment when we were looking at the genocide in Central Europe. Not acting when you see genocide in retrospect is never a good idea. So by focusing just on the genocide in Darfur, we're doing a number of things. Number one, it's a very discrete number of companies we're targeting. And those companies have been pressured. A number of them have been pressured to disinvest from Sudan. 70% of the money the military that is committing the genocide in Sudan receives comes from their oil royalties and tax revenue. These are primarily mineral companies that we're targeting. Not a single of the companies we're targeting is an American company, because by United States, by federal law, American companies are not allowed to participate in activities in Sudan that support the genocide. So if you look at the list that we have, there's only six companies that the Permanent Fund is invested in. They're all Chinese or other foreign national companies. It's a very small, discrete list. They are largely mineral companies. And then the retirement board and none of the other funds, the other state funds that we'd regulate, don't have any investments in any of these companies. There are companies, big companies like BP, that invest in Sudan, but we're not going to require anybody disinvest from BP because we're only requiring disinvestment from companies that support the Sudanese military. So BP, they produce consumer goods. They run gas stations in Sudan. Consumers rely on consumer goods. The bill is carefully targeted to not take away investments from companies that produce consumer goods. We're targeting just companies that are complicit in the genocide. It's a large Chinese gas company. It's a large Chinese parent company of the gas company and a couple others. Let me know if I didn't respond to your question enough, but your prior question about do other states have anything like the Permanent Fund, they don't. But CalPERS, I would suspect, and California has passed a law just like this. CalPERS, I would suspect, is a much bigger fund than the Permanent Fund. New York PERS, I would suspect, is a much bigger fund than the Permanent Fund. So other states don't have a Permanent Fund, but they have entities that are banned from investing in companies that support the genocide in Sudan.
Representative Hanson, do you want to follow up?
Yeah. Thank you, and I appreciate the co-prime sponsor's testimony skill. He's very skilled. Very skilled testifier, but if I wasn't clear in my question, number one, what about the rest of these countries that have been identified by this group that is providing backup for your bill addressed? Are those atrocities, in your mind, less than what's going on in Darfur? And again, number two, have you considered introducing legislation to direct the investment policies of the board itself in general rather than the specific country? So two specific questions, and I'd like a response.
Sure. The answer is no, we haven't, at least from my office's perspective, we haven't considered adding the other countries. This is the greatest atrocity possibly going on the earth today. 200,000 people killed in a genocide, 2 million people stuck in refugee camps where they don't have water, don't have food, and those are among the people who are dying in Sudan today or in Chad, in neighboring Chad. I can tell you that I don't have the greatest knowledge about some of the other atrocities going on in the world to tell you how close they come to equating to a genocide of innocent civilians in Sudan. I would certainly welcome other members of the committee to decide whether or not we should take a look at that as well. But you don't decide not to solve a problem just because there are other problems that you're not solving. And this is a very discreet one. It involves only foreign national companies on an issue that Congress has already regulated. There was some question until December whether states could do this, and Congress said, yes, states can do this. We support state efforts to try and do this. And so they passed legislation in December that this summer that President Bush signed in December. It's a bipartisan effort in Congress, and it, I think, should be a bipartisan effort here. I do understand the slippery slope that you're talking about. We've tried not to go down the slippery slope. We've identified what we think is the worst atrocity situation going on in the world today. It's discreet. It involves very few companies, and it's worked. Just in the last month, Weatherford International, an oil field service company, under pressure from the states and other entities that have decided not to invest in the genocide in Sudan, has disinvested from Sudan. Not only did they disinvest, but under the pressure, they left their equipment there for humanitarian purposes. This is working. There are a number of companies that have disinvested from Sudan since this has started. And, you know, there's a question, will Alaska make a difference? And, you know, I think it will, because you never know what your impact is on the world by yourself, but you know when you join with others, there is an impact. So does any state know that when they joined in this divestment movement, they caused Weatherford to disinvest? No. But if you join together, I think you have, and you make a powerful moral statement, I think together you do make a difference.
Just one final
follow-up.
I appreciate the fact that you recognize the slippery slope concept, and I guess for me it's really, you know, who decides what is atrocious enough and where do you draw the line, and it's difficult for me to try and figure out who's going to make the call. I mean, and that's the slippery slope. So, and I also appreciate the passion of both co-sponsors bringing this forward. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we find out eventually that the military is using British petroleum gas to fill up their vehicles, will British petroleum be excluded from this list?
Through the chairman, Representative Johnson, no. British petroleum won't be excluded. The decision has been made that the companies that are primarily providing consumer services in the country, we're not going to regulate with this bill, and that's what the other states have largely done. What you're really looking at are the companies that are providing resources and equipment to the Sudanese government, which runs the military, which is engaging in the genocide. That's why it's only such a small, discrete number of companies. There are hundreds of foreign companies operating in Sudan right now, but it's a very small number that would be regulated by this bill. 70% of the money that the Sudanese military comes from their oil revenue, and more from their mineral revenue. Those are largely the companies, but not BP, because they're largely just a consumer company in Sudan.
Representative Johnson, follow up.
Along the slippery slope issue of the 20 or so or however many states, can you tell me how many of those states have gone beyond Sudan and now they're into regulating another country or two or three or political issues down the road other than countries? Do you know that information?
We don't know the answer to that, through the chair, Representative Johnson. I can tell you that, you know, probably not a similar level of atrocity, but similarly disturbing was what used to go on in South Africa with apartheid. And back then, the disinvestment movement was focused on South Africa, even though there were other atrocities going on in the world at the time. I can only suspect that there are very few states, if any, that are regulating investments in other countries, but I can't tell you that for sure. This is the line that we've drawn is genocide, and that's the line that other states are drawing. And it's not only a line on genocide, it's a line on genocide that's been recognized by the President of the United States and the Congress of the United States.
Representative Johnson, continue.
Mr. Chairman, I believe the number is six other states that have gone with Sudan or in, I don't know their states, but other funds that have gone, and I think Iran's the one that's been listed. My concern is that's the slippery slope concerns me greatly. I can see the next thing before us is, hospitals that perform abortions.
or hospitals that don't perform abortions or tobacco companies. My concern rests, I am certainly sympathetic, and I wish we were talking about hospitals and not something this atrocious. It would make the argument much easier for me to try to make, because I'm torn by this. But I'm terribly concerned that once we do this, if we start directing investment based on politics, there's no end to the site. And I just, you know, we hear the camel nose under the tent. We hear all of those things. And I just am concerned that once we start directing investment based upon politics, and letting this body direct investment is a different issue. I mean, I don't fix my car because I don't know how. If this body starts getting involved in investments, I'm concerned that that's an area that I just don't want to go in. Once again, I wish it were a different topic. This is not something that I'm sympathetic to at all. I wish we were talking about something that we could base just a pure political decision and not an emotional decision on, but emotions rise very high in this, and as they, for me, I don't want to see a single child hurt, a single bullet fired in anger or any of that, but I'm concerned about once we start down the road, is Iran next? Is it something that at some point says we don't want to invest in any company that's a Democrat or Republican? I mean, where does this end? I don't know where it ends. That's the concern, but I do know where it starts. And that's my concern. Once again, I wish it was a different topic. This is heartbreaking, and it's terrible. But I just have that concern.
Representative Dahl.
Well, I understand where you're coming from. You know, it's an interesting thing. We all get so frustrated about moral and injustice across the world, and people go out and demonstrate and write letters to the editor and wave flags and so forth, and nothing ever happens with all the hand-wringing. Because in the end, it's always money talks. And so if you go to the economics, that's when wars are won, basically. And I don't mean with bullets or with guns. It's won oftentimes just fit with economics. And I was just thinking about Gandhi and the salt tax. The British didn't pay attention until they had to lose money with the salt tax. And even in the American Revolution, no one paid any attention until that we decided not to pay the stamp tax, and then all of a sudden things started to happen. And so, you know, we get these embargoes all the time on various economic things, and it makes differences. So I think in this case, you know, we just have to put, you know, see where the power is coming from. And usually it comes from the giving of money. So I am sympathetic to this, and I'm looking forward to further testifying today.
Mr. Chair, may I just address Representative Johnson's point really briefly?
Sure.
Mr. Chair, I understand the slippery slope, Representative Johnson, and that's why we're not walking on it. You don't end up on the slippery slope unless you start walking on it, and we're limiting this just to one country to stay away from the slippery slope. It's genocide. The people of the state of Alaska, I don't think, want to make money off of genocide, and right now we are. Now, if we decide there are other things that we want to regulate, I think somebody can file legislation, and you'll find out that the things that are less important, that involve less violence, that don't involve genocide, are going to be much more controversial. But this is genocide, and this one, I think, it should be less controversial.
Any other questions from the committee for the sponsor? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I could probably line up equal number of people on both sides that would say abortion is genocide. I mean, either side of that issue. So, you know, if that's going to be your criteria, then that's the other question I have is, are there any exceptions in this legislation to any of the investments that are involved in the government? Are there any other exceptions in here that are being made as a result of investment funds? I mean, is it just the ones in the military, or are there other exceptions in here?
Through the chair, we have some people on the line that could get into more of the technicalities of how you target a company, and I would defer that question to them.
Mr. Chair, just briefly, it's not just the military it's not just support of the military that we're saying is the criteria for deciding whether your company is on the bad list. It's support of the government, but largely it ends up, given that the major support for the government is through mineral revenue in Sudan, it's largely the extracting companies that have chosen to help make money off the genocide in Sudan. There are other places to invest in the world. You know, companies cannot decide often cannot decide where to invest based on a social conscience. You know, the corporate charter in every state says that companies have to maximize the benefit of their shareholders. It doesn't say they have to make philosophical decisions. That's our job. But the definition is support of the Sudanese government in a way that helps the Sudanese government engage in the genocide. It excludes consumer goods. It excludes companies that provide humanitarian help. It excludes companies that are doing things that are not support for the Sudanese government that relates to their funding of the military. And the other states that have done this have largely adopted language similar to ours. Some have banned all investments in Sudan, but that's messy. Then all of a sudden you're banning investments in companies that are providing services that people of Sudan rely on.
Were these six companies that you're targeting invested in that company prior to the atrocities reaching to the level of concern that they've reached?
Mr. Chair, I can tell you that the genocide started around 2003. The states started enacting laws in 2006. Those laws tend to have an 18-month lag period, except for the ones where the governor's done it by executive order. I can't tell you how long these companies have been involved in working in Sudan. I can tell you that the pressure has only started to bear very recently, given the legislation only started to pass in 2006, and they tend to have an 18-month lag period to let fund investors prudently disinvest over a period of time instead of right away.
And the reason that I asked the question the way I did was because of the statement that you made that these companies are making profit off of genocide. And I asked the question the way I did because I think most of those companies were probably making a profit before the atrocities started. And so with their investments they've made there, they've continued to operate in the country. And so if it was a company that started doing business after, then I would say, yes, they probably are very directly involved in funding the genocide. But if they were there long before it started, so it doesn't make it any less despicable. Just a point of clarification. So any other questions from the committee for the sponsor? You're seeing none. I have a long list of people wanting to testify, so we're going to go to public testimony. It looks as though most everyone that wants to testify is in the audience, so I'm going to go to the folks online first so we can clear that up. I have two that are here that said they're online just to ask questions, but I will give them an opportunity to testify in case they've changed their mind. I'm going to start with Kelly Nixon. Kelly, are you there?
Yes, thank you.
And please
I actually have something I prepared to read.
Getting a little feedback there. Please state your name and any affiliation that you might have, and please try to keep your statements as succinct and brief as possible. And proceed.
Hello, my name is Kelly Nixon. I live at 2439 Ronnie Place in Anchorage, Alaska. I am a member of Save Darfur Anchorage. Our group consists of Alaskans from the communities of Anchorage, Eagle River, and Wasilla, who believe strongly that we have an ethical responsibility to do what we can to end the Darfur genocide. The government of Sudan continues to refuse to cooperate with the United Nations, and the instability in the Darfur region has caused most humanitarian efforts to pull out. There are therefore very few avenues for facilitating an end to this genocide or offering support to the people of Darfur. Targeted divestment is one of the few. This international effort acknowledges the debt-ridden government of Sudan's reliance on foreign direct investment to finance its military and Janjaweed militias, and goes after the foreign companies that are most egregious in their support of the current Khartoum regime, without sacrificing investment profits. So far, 22 states have adopted a policy of targeted divestment, and 17 others will consider this policy this year. Through targeted divestment, we can collectively exert enough pressure on the government of Sudan through these foreign companies to compel a shift in focus from destruction and annihilation to one of stability. We understand that some perceive House Bill 287 as a threat to how our state invests. We know that there is resistance to passing this legislation. But we ask, as you consider HB 287, that you remain mindful of how easily our state can implement this policy and how truly horrific genocide is. Genocide calls for all of us to look hard and deep at ourselves, at our actions and our inactions, and ask ourselves if we, as humans, are doing what we can to fight against it. Are we offering support, relief, or hope to the people of Darfur who are right now, right this minute, facing a very deliberate and systematic destruction of their culture and their lives? This genocide will end one day, and the true horrors faced by the millions affected will be revealed. Many Americans will reflect on this time and will wish they had done more, that they had done something. But at that point, it will be too late. We hope when that day of reflection comes, Alaskans will be able to say proudly that we took a stand against genocide. Thank you.
Thank you, Kelly. Are there any questions from the committee for Kelly Nixon?
No, thank you.
Any questions?
No, for me.
Okay. Thank you, Kelly, for not only your passion, but also for your coming forward and making a statement. Thank you. I will next go to Tamara Shea.
Hi. Hello.
Please give us your name and any affiliation that might have, and try to keep your statements down to 3 minutes if you could.
Okay.
Thank you.
My name is Tamara Shea, and I volunteer with Save Darfur Anchorage. Because of the huge numbers involved, I think it can be difficult for us to grasp the death of hundreds of thousands or the displacement of millions. And what helps me personally is to imagine one person, my counterpart in Darfur, a woman in her mid-30s, a wife, a mother, and I think about what her days are like. And I see her in the refugee camp where she lives with her older daughters. She's already lived through the beating deaths of her husband, older sons, and infant. And the camp is no safer than the village. There are no real sources of water or firewood within the camp. So militiamen lie in wait on the periphery of the camp, waiting for a woman so thirsty or so hungry that she's willing to risk being gang-raped by the men that murdered her husband and children just so she can find water or firewood for her and her family. So I think about my counterpart and her typical day, and then I multiply her story by a million. If we've learned anything from the Holocaust, it's this. The perpetrators of genocide depend on good people standing by and allowing the atrocities to happen. President al-Bashir of Sudan needs us to turn a blind eye in order to systematically eliminate the Darfuri people. I understand that managing Alaska's permanent fund is complex, and it's the role of the managers to maximize profit for the people of Alaska. But in response to the slippery slope issue, you may be able to find people who feel that abortion is genocide or think that we should include other atrocities, but our president and the U.S. Congress have declared Darfur and only Darfur to be a genocide. That's where the slippery slope can stop. So my question is, there nothing really too awful, too cruel, or too inhumane for us to financially support? Isn't genocide in a class of its own? And if the Permanent Fund had been operating during the Holocaust, would we have invested in the final solution so long as it was profitable? One thing is for certain, history is going to judge us. Will we be viewed as profiteers of ethnic cleansing? Or will we be remembered as a community that refused to be exploited by the perpetrators of genocide? Look, you know, I'm your typical Alaskan. When October comes and that PFD check comes, there is nobody happier than me. But please, let me feel good about depositing that check into my children's college savings accounts. Don't let their future be financed by genocide. Thank you.
Thank you, Tamara, for your enthusiastic testimony. Any questions from any of the committee members for Tamara? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
I also have online, and they said they were on just to answer questions, but in case you've changed your mind since some of the testimony you've heard, Nina McMurray, are you there, or do you wish to stay online to answer questions?
This is Nina McMurray. I think my colleague, Max Crows, who's also from the Sudan Divestment Task Force, did want to say a few things in response to the previous testimony.
Nina?
Through the chair, this is Max Crows of the Sudan Divestment Task Force. I wanted to address a couple of the issues that were raised by members of the committee and also open myself up to questions. I'm happy to answer any inquiries that they might have. The first thing that I would like to address, of course, is the 8 conflicts as identified on our website, genocideintervention.net, and, of course, also thank the committee member for accessing our website. We do appreciate that. As far as those 8 conflicts go, it is necessary to note that none of them are currently categorized as a genocide. And the unique situation that is displayed in Darfur is that the federal government, the president, and Congress have all declared that Darfur is a genocide while atrocities are still ongoing, this being the only time in American history that such a declaration has been made. This was not declared during the Holocaust or the Rwandan tragedies, but only now has genocide been declared in Darfur, Sudan. Going further into the identification of companies and the efficacy of divestment, this is not a feel-good action. Nine corporations have withdrawn or substantially altered their policies in Darfur and throughout Sudan to reflect the fact that their contributions to the Sudanese government may be and probably are being funneled directly to the Sudanese military to wage the campaign there. These corporations have developed humanitarian programs or refused to continue offering their money to the government of Sudan. As everyone in Alaska, I'm sure, knows, every time the pipeline doesn't transit oil, the state loses money. And similarly, the government of Sudan knows that every time a corporation pulls out or restricts its access to their markets, that they, as well, lose money and lose the ability to wage the genocide in Darfur. Companies are targeted on three criteria that are specifically noted. First, whether or not they contract with the government of Sudan or its projects. Second, whether or not they assist any of the marginalized populations in Sudan. And third, whether or not they address specifically the fact that their dollars could be contributed to the genocide there. The example that we can pull out of this is, of course, the BP reference that was made earlier. We could draw a similar analogy to Coca-Cola. Does the Sudanese government and the military drink Coca-Cola? Most likely they do, but the situation is that Coca-Cola does not contract directly with the government of Sudan and does not contribute their profits to the genocide in Darfur. Specifically, what we do is target those corporations, and as we see through the holdings of the Permanent Fund, this is a minuscule amount that is capable of being divested. I think that one of the major things we should address is that this is a policy that's effective at ending the genocide in Darfur and also one that can safely and responsibly be implemented without harming returns of the Permanent Fund or any other organizations. I'm happy to answer any questions as well.
Any questions from the committee members for Matt Cross? Seeing none, thank you, Mac. And I assume, Tina, that that was the same testimony you wished to give?
Yeah. I actually have one more thing to add, if that's okay.
Please proceed
I wanted
record.
To, in addressing the slippery slope argument, I wanted to quickly mention that while there are some other calls for divestment out there and potential other issues where divestment could come up, targeted Sudan divestment is the only strategy that has been explicitly authorized by the United States government with the recent passage and signing of the Sudan Accountability and Divestment Act, which explicitly encourages and authorizes states to enact targeted Sudan divestment along the same lines as HB 287. So I wanted to add that in there, and I'm happy to answer any questions about that particular piece of legislation or any questions that you might have in general. Thank you.
Would you please state your full name and any affiliation for the record, please?
My name is Nina McMurray, and I am also with the Sudan Divestment Task Force and the Genocide Intervention Network.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee members? Seeing none, thank you, Nina. Anyone else we have online? Thank you. Okay, I'm then going to go to the audience. And again, the same thing, if you could please restrict your comments to about 3 minutes and try to be as precise as possible. Lauren Tibbetts.
My name is Lauren Tibbetts Travis, and I am the president of the Juno chapter of Students Taking Action Now Darfur. I thank you all for allowing us to testify today. My father always says that it's not the way that you say something, but how you actively follow your words. We can all verbally say that genocide is wrong, but if we don't use actions, no one cares. If we don't go over and say, stop, and we only sit on our couches and say, that's wrong, then we're not affecting change. If we decide to pass this legislation and divest from companies who are actively okay with the genocide in Darfur, then we are allowing ourselves to contradict our own words of never again, and we are allowing ourselves to be okay with murder. Murder, although it is our laws, is illegal. And we define murder as the killing of a person. Murder is wrong in our eyes, in our country. Why can't we decide that when we witness murder, then we also are okay with it. Why are we allowing ourselves to fund the murder? As one who will soon inherit a permanent fund dividend, as one who will be a voting member of society, I feel that it is important for the children of today to know that our permanent fund dividend is not necessarily funding genocide, but is invested in companies that do. If we pull out from those companies, then we are declaring ourselves free from guilt. If we can pull out of companies that are funding genocide, we are saying we're thinking that this is wrong, that we know this is wrong. The Darfur women are being raped. Darfur men are being murdered in their sleep, beaten to death. Everyone in Darfur is being systematically killed for no other reason than being there, than living in Darfur. In a country that is mainly Islamic, the Darfur people are mainly Christian and animist, or traditional tribal spirituality. And that is one of the main reasons that they are being targeted. Not because of anything else, but mainly because of race, that they are traditional black Africans, that they are a different culture, and that they are different, is what it all boils down to. Permanent fund dividend should not allow this. Permanent fund dividend is what we will all give our children. It is a legacy that will pass down for generations. And as a young woman, I feel that it is important for me to know, for my children to know, that our state is not alone in deciding that we will not fund murder. Thank you.
Any questions for Lauren from the committee? I have one.
Did you say you represented a group?
I started the Juno chapter of Students Taking Action Now Darfur earlier this year.
What grade are you in?
I am a sophomore.
First of all, I want to tell you I taught school for 20 years, and I think you represented the students very well, and you were very articulate, and congratulations on taking action. Whether we agree or disagree with your position, you certainly have stated it well, and I certainly thank you for stepping forward and getting actively involved, and I hope you will encourage more students to do the same.
Thank you, Vice Chair.
Thank you, Lord. Michael Schneider, or Sheldoner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify. First of all, I'd like to say,
for the record, before I hate to interrupt you, but for the record, please state your full name and any affiliation that you might have for the record.
Right. My name is Michael Schuldiner, and I'm a member of the Representative Assembly of United Academics, AAUP-AFT, which met here just yesterday. But before I get into the resolution that we passed on behalf of House Bill 287, I'd first of all like to say that I hope everyone on this committee will pay very close attention to what that student just said. This is a very rare opportunity for you and for the state legislature to inspire students with your moral integrity, students throughout the state who are studying precisely this issue. As a teacher, this is a very important issue to me. What I have to do is I have to tell my students that we live in a great state where there are important issues. I teach Holocaust literature, and so this issue is something that is close to me. My parents lived through the Holocaust. My in-laws were Auschwitz survivors. And I can tell you that the way genocide happens is when good people like yourselves stand by and do nothing. What I'd like to do now is read to you the resolution that was passed by United Academics, AAUPAFT. Whereas the government of Sudan has engaged in a policy of genocide against its own civilians in Darfur through the use of its military and through sponsorship of attacks by armed militias known as Janjaweed. And whereas the Janjaweed and military of the Sudanese government are responsible for razing over 80% of Darfur's villages, gang-raping civilians, slaughtering a minimum of 200,000 victims, displacing 2.5 million more, using forced starvation as a weapon of war, and impeding access of humanitarian aid to up to 3.5 million Darfurians that are now reliant on assistance. And whereas the Sudanese government and Janjaweed militias have continued their attacks despite the signing of the Darfur peace agreement. And whereas the Darfur crisis represents the first time that the U.S. Congress, State Department, and President have declared a genocide while the atrocities are ongoing. And whereas the International Criminal Court in The Hague has charged Sudanese officials with 51 counts of crimes against humanity and war crimes in Darfur, including the murder, rape, torture, and sometimes in the most horrible fashion, persecution of civilians. Whereas certain international companies operating in Sudan bring significant revenue, cover, and arms to the Sudanese government while providing little benefit to the majority of Sudan's citizens. And whereas Khartoum has funneled the majority of foreign direct investment from these companies into military expenditures used to perpetuate the genocide while neglecting needed development projects in the Darfur region. And whereas the current Sudan divestment movement now encompasses nearly 100 universities, cities, states, and private pension plans, whereas the divestment movement has already gained the attention of the Sudanese government and altered the behavior of some companies operating in Sudan, whereas House Bill number 287 introduced January 4th, 2008, in the legislature of the state of Alaska is a bill for, quote, an act relating to certain investments of the Alaska Permanent Fund, the state's retirement systems, the state of Alaska supplemental annuity plan, and the deferred compensation program for state employees and companies that do business in Sudan, and restricting those investments. Therefore, be it resolved that United Academics, AAUPAFT, representing the Upper Division Teaching Faculty and Research Faculty of the University of Alaska System, and I might add that we're talking about approximately 940 faculty and researchers statewide across the entire state, introduced in 2008 into the 25th legislative session, second session of the state of Alaska. Thank you.
Any questions for Michael? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Martha Quinn. Is Martha Quinn? Didn't say whether you want to testify or not. Is Martha still here?
Yeah.
Okay. Patton Ramos?
My name is actually Patricia Moss.
Okay.
I'm speaking on for myself, but I am the founder of an international writers group called When Does Never Again Begin? I have a prepared statement, but I would like to just take 1 second to respond to Representative Johnson's remark that his concern of whether we should become involved in some sort of slippery slope. This is a divestment issue, and we are involved. Our money is involved, as we all well know. As we roll past the calendar date for the second annual International Holocaust Remembrance Day, we stand here in testimony about whether or not we should do whatever we can to stop another systematic extermination. Since the European Holocaust, Jewish people have a saying, never again. When does never again begin? This is the question put to me once by one of my sons after studying the Holocaust and the Rwanda genocide. How could the world allow this to happen? Mom, when does never again begin? That question was a life-changing event for me. The people of Alaska want to know, will you make us financially complicit in a genocide by refusing to divest from Sudan? Will you force us to be the German village with ashes of our complicity falling upon us through the daily media reports and through our PFD checks? Is part of our children's inheritance from Alaska going to be the knowledge in the future that weighs upon the hearts of the people of Europe? Or will you act as liberators of the Darfur victims through targeted divestment? May I suggest that applying the multiplication table to a genocide could be viewed as immoral in post-legislation debates should you fail to pass this bill? And may I also suggest that the issue of future reparations is a major liability for the state of Alaska and a reality in the post-situations for other genocidal events? The people of Alaska do not support genocide. The people of Alaska did not support the Holocaust. Will you associate your good names and the good names of your constituents with financial support for the genocidal policies of the Sudan when 22 other states have chosen to divest? If the accountants for the state of Alaska are savvy enough to create a wealth equal to the ninth richest country on earth, then surely they can recover $10 million risk associated in the language opposing this action. You have a responsibility to protect and to oversee the applications of the moral principles of the people of Alaska. This bill is not a profit and loss decision. It is about who we are, whether we are arrogant or whether we are compassionate. Please keep in mind that all that is necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. When does never again begin? In this matter before you, I want it to begin with our divestment, and I ask you to support this bill. Thank you.
Any questions for Patricia? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Is it Roger or Royce Severson? Can't read it. That's why we have you state your name on the record in case we mess it up.
Wish you could do something about my penmanship. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Severson, and I'm here as an independent citizen. What impresses me about this bill is that it seems to me, if I may use the language, to be a surgical strike. They're talking about approximately six companies. I think it makes a lot of sense to do this. In fact, I don't wish to offend anyone, but it sounds to me pretty much like a no-brainer. We can't really continue activities that propagate or perpetuate this kind of behavior in Darfur, and frankly, I think elsewhere as well. So briefly speaking, I would just encourage the legislature to pass Bill 287. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Linda Layfield.
Greetings. My name is Linda Layfield, and I am a concerned citizen of the state of Alaska. And it seems to me that today it has been made abundantly clear that the situation in Darfur is the greatest atrocity that is happening in the world today. Thankfully, the United States government has recognized it as a genocide. And being a genocide, I think that it is extremely time sensitive. I don't think there's time to consider other versions of this bill or other countries, adding other countries or other atrocities that are going on. If you remember, in Rwanda, 1994, it took 90 days to kill approximately a million people. However, in those 90 days in 1994, that was not the limit of what happened in Rwanda. The atrocities really started in 1988, and they continued clear through to 2002. So there was a question earlier about if the companies we're talking about were there before this. I don't think that these atrocities that are happening now in Darfur have just started happening, or, you know, last year it seems like is when we became aware of it. These things are the kinds of things that grow until they come to the attention of people, of places like the United States government. Already they have achieved numbers to be approximately a quarter of the numbers of what happened in Rwanda. I think it would be horrible to wait long enough for them to achieve numbers as great or greater than what happened in Rwanda. In Rwanda today, in every village, there are memorials that are grim reminders of the shameful neglect of the Western world in not recognizing the genocide that happened there. I had the privilege to be in attendance at the Olympics in Munich, and the day after the Israeli athletes were killed, there was a moratorium that day, and everything at the Olympics was just made a day later. And on that day, I visited the museum at Dachau. At the exit of the museum in Dachau, there is a sign on the door, and it's a quote from Santana that says something like, "If we do not remember our past, we're destined to repeat it." I think we have an opportunity here to not allow the world, we're a small piece, but I think we have a small opportunity here to not allow the world to repeat what happened in Rwanda in 1994. So I would just urge you, I'm a great believer in the fact, and it was brought up earlier in the first testimony about this bill, that every little bit helps, and we are a little bit of this situation, but I do think that our little bit can have an impact. So I certainly urge you to support the passage of this bill. Thank you.
Any questions for Linda? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. And we are getting close to the end here. Is it Joanne or Joanna Bloom? Mm-hmm. Please state your name for the record and any affiliation that you may have.
Yes. Thank you, Vice Chair. My name is Joanne Bloom, and I live at 883 Basin Road here in Juneau. And who I am is a grateful recipient of the Alaska Permanent Fund since the checks first started coming in 1982. But I'm also a proud board member of the American Jewish World Service, and you have a handout in front of you from our organization. It's been a leader in the movement to end the genocide in Darfur, and it was one of the first national organizations to endorse targeted divestment from Sudan. I want to thank you so very much for choosing to take up this legislation and giving the people of Alaska the opportunity to take this stand against the atrocities in Darfur. So thank you very much. I'm actually kind of in awe of being here in this committee room today, because before, when I've gone to support the people of Darfur, I've traveled all the way across country. I've gone to the enormous celebrity-filled rallies in Washington, D.C., and I've gone to New York as well, Central Park in New York City. And today I just had to walk five blocks from my house to come to this room with our Alaskan celebrities. And I think together here we can do more to end the genocide in Sudan. I got this pin when I was in Washington, D.C., and I got these bracelets when I was in New York. And the bracelets and the pin, well, they might be kind of gimmicky. But what you're doing today by passing this legislation is not gimmicky. It's the real thing. You're letting the world know that Alaska will not be silent in the face of crimes against humanity, that it's not okay to fund companies whose business with the Sudanese government helps to fuel a genocide that has taken the lives of, and here's those numbers again, at least 200,000 people and caused 2.5 million people to lose their homes and to live in fear of their lives every day. I've looked at the fiscal note that the permanent funds attached to this bill, and frankly, I think it's absurd. I'm no economist, but their estimated cost of $10 to $14 million to divest less than 0.1% of their portfolio, well, that sounds like gobbledygook math to me. I understand the permanent fund doesn't want to be dictated by political whims. We know that's not what this bill is about. This bipartisan bill is about ethics. We in Alaska want to show that we can do the ethical thing. We want to join the federal government and the 22 other states which have done their part to intensify the pressure on the Sudanese government to end the genocide now. I've lost family members in another genocide, and I'm here to bear witness. Please, let's do whatever we can, big and small, directly and indirectly, with words and with dollars, to stop the genocide in Darfur. And I thank you.
Any questions for Joy-Ann? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. This committee meeting was scheduled to end at 1 o'clock. We've gone beyond that, and I just have about, at the most, three, four more people that are going to testify in this bill. So with the patience of this committee, I would at least like to get through the public testimony. If you can hang in and bear with me, I would appreciate it. Thank you very much. So we will continue. We have one more person online. Ashley Straley, are you there?
Yes, hello.
Ashley, go ahead. Please give us your name and any affiliation that you might have for the record, and then proceed.
My name is Ashley Straley. I'm representing myself. I wanted to thank the committee for hearing this bill. I am very thankful that Alaska gets the chance to take responsibility and pull out of the genocide. Any investments that we have in the genocide in Sudan. I just wanted to urge the committee members that it, as human beings, we each have the responsibility to acknowledge the fact that there's a genocide going on. And as a human, I take responsibility for what's going on, and I'll do anything that I can to end this. This has gone on for 5 years. This is a good bill. I think the fiscal note also may seem a little high. I would argue the fact that it would take $10 million to actually get this done. But, you know, the permanent fund is something that Alaskans have always taken pride in having, and the rest of the world knows about the permanent fund, but I don't think the Alaskans would really be excited and happy to know that part of that money comes from, you know, it's dirty money. You know, there's bloodshed, and we get money, and that to me is just appalling. so I'll be brief. But I wanted to thank you guys for all the work that you're doing, and I do hope that this bill will pass out of the committee and make its way through, and Alaska can take part in divesting from the genocide in Sudan. Thank you.
Thank you, Ashley. Any questions? Representative Johansson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ashley, it's just nice to hear your voice. She worked in this building, was hired by the Rules Chairman as a page, and is very familiar with the process, and it's just nice to hear from you. I know you're busy writing papers and going to school, so anyway, that's all.
Thank you. Okay. No one else online, I assume. Okay, good. And do not take any more online. We're going to limit ourselves to those that are currently signed up, and that's the end of it. Laura Agee? Laura, did you want
to? We're going to get it, yeah.
I gathered that. Please state your name for the record and what affiliation you may have and proceed with your testimony.
Which one's Laura?
I believe they'll self-identify.
I'm Michael Burns, and I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Permanent Fund. And with me is Laura Ashe, Director of Communications. Good afternoon. I appreciate your willingness to hear us on this. First of all, Mr. Chairman, I would like to say that we sincerely appreciate the motivation that has led the sponsor to introduce this legislation. We are all deeply disturbed by the incomprehensible situation that is taking place in Darfur. And we respect that it is the legislature's prerogative to direct us in how to invest the Alaska Permanent Fund. If the legislature directs the trustees and staff to divest assets from the fund in the manner prescribed in this bill, we will do so. However, we urge you not to take this step. In 30 years, the Alaska Permanent Fund has only been invested for the financial benefit of the people of Alaska, and never to enact a social or political agenda. Placing a social investment directive on the fund would be a significant change to our core mission. We believe that the prudent course of action is to make investment decisions on strictly economic grounds, and we do not believe that investment decisions made for social or political reasons are in the best interests of the permanent fund. After the question of prudence is the question of efficacy. We are discouraged at the prospect of placing a socially motivated directive on the permanent fund, a directive that will have some costs when we have not seen definitive proof that these divestment efforts are effective. To support our point, we have included a summary of a paper in your bill packets that reviews the effect that divestment from South African investments had on the decision to end apartheid. The researchers concluded that it was not divestment, but rather many other forms of pressure brought to bear on the South African government that caused the change in their practices. Before I conclude, I would like to touch on some concerns held by both the U.S. Treasury Department and the U.S. State Department, both of which are actively involved in trying to bring about an end to the genocide in Darfur. We don't speak for these agencies, but choosing to enact divestment legislation is a significant decision that will affect our state's investments and investment policies well into the future, and we think you should have all the facts as you deliberate. We have included testimony in our packet from representatives of both of these federal agencies before the Senate Banking Committee, and you will find that the common theme is that Treasury and State believe that individual divestment policies at the state level, rather than helping, will in fact hinder their efforts. I appreciate the opportunity to share our concerns as you make this very important decision, and we will be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Laura, did you have anything you wanted to add?
No, I don't.
Any questions from the committee members? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're really talking about, and it's been stated over and over and over, that we're just talking about a little bit of the fund. Yet we're still, and even in the companies like British Petroleum that pumps gas, the taxes that they collect on that, unless they have no taxes on that, go to the government, which go to the military, which go to the genocide. So really any company that does business there is complicit
if you want to take it out to the furthest. If they pay a tax, it goes to the government. And so if we're going to do this and we're going to really have an impact, my question is, what would it do if we were to say we will divest of any company that does business there that pays any taxes to the government, which is then funneled to the military? So what would we be looking at if we were to really make a statement and not just, you know, these six companies that we can clearly identify, but all companies that do business there? What kind of impact could we have, and what would that do to the fund? That's a tough question.
It is a tough question. I guess maybe even narrowing it to the list that's already in existence. People talk about the six companies that are part of our portfolio today. I think there's, and I have not seen the full list, or I haven't counted, probably 60 to 80 companies that are on the list that are not part of our portfolio. People have talked about the cost of this and question the cost in this. It's not the selling of the six companies. It's the ongoing monitoring of the list of 60 to 80 to make sure that they're not in the portfolio, they're not added to the portfolio. That cost gets spread across all of our managers, well in excess of 50 managers. Their additional costs passed along. So the cost is monitoring that broader list, which in the hypothetical that you put forth becomes even broader still. So that's where the costs lie. I'm not sure if I answered your question. Well, the specific question you asked, I actually don't have an answer to, but it's hard to.
Please continue.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be real surprised if you did. But the point is, if we're going to do this, let's do it. If we're going to make the statement, and why, I mean, is this something that is just to make people feel good? If we're really going to have an impact, let's go out and let's divest of investing in genocide. And what I'm looking for is, if we're going to do it and it's not just something that, you know, we can go home and sleep good at night, that we're really going to have an impact, why don't we do that? And I might be able more supportive of something that I thought was going to go out and have a real, you know, that we were really going to get behind it and not just pick six companies or potentially 60. So that's more of a statement than a question. The other question on the bill on page 3, line 30. Can you tell me what an indirect holding in assets of a company is? Are we really just going to take the six companies and they're going to become indirect holdings, so we're really going to have no effect? I mean, is there a potential for that? And what is an indirect holding? And explain to me how that works and why that would be excluded if we were really trying to accomplish the goal.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I believe where they're headed with that is the difference between what we own 100 shares directly of ConocoPhillips. I think what they're talking about there is a commingled fund, which we do have several. It's not our preferred method, but in the fund, it's more like a mutual fund. Actually, we do own one mutual fund, an international mutual fund, where we actually own shares in the fund, and the underlying assets are held by that fund. So we have, I think, two commingled funds, one of which is a pure mutual fund, and we would probably have to get out of those because we don't control that investment decision. We're in it with other people, and our dollars are commingled with other owners.
Mr. Chairman, if I could.
Continue.
So there's nothing stopping those six companies. I mean, how do you become part of a commingled fund? Could these six companies and that were mentioned, could they just say, fine, we'll get our investment and we'll join this commingled fund and do anything like that? Is there a way around what we're doing? I mean, I guess.
No, through the chair, Representative Johnson, they don't control whether they're part of a commingled fund. The manager that manages the commingled fund would make the decision as to whether they wanted to invest in that particular company or any particular company. So the companies that are on this list don't make the decision to become part of a commingled fund. Someone selects them. So, and that selection is out of our hands.
And so I guess maybe the question is, are any of those six companies in commingled funds? Do we know that? I mean, is there any way to know that?
We don't know that, yeah. Through the chair.
Well, Laura, since you haven't testified yet, please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Laura Ashay, I'm the Director of Communications for the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Through the chair, Representative Johnson, we haven't done any screens on our investments. The six companies that are being mentioned are, we post our holdings online, and this is what we're being told by the folks that have screened. It is very possible that some of the companies on the scrutinized list could be in those two commingled funds. They are actually non-U.S. commingled funds, so they could potentially be in there, and if they are, this legislation wouldn't require us to divest from them. So that possibility exists. And if I can add just a thought regarding to cost as well, there's been mention of six companies. The permanent fund holds 3,000 shares of 3,000 companies on any given day, and that number changes every day. We sell, we buy, and I think what we're trying to get at when we discuss our costs, we haven't looked at all at the potential cost with regard to investment losses of divesting from any companies. We've only looked at the administrative costs of ensuring that we would divest from any companies that were on the list and that we wouldn't purchase them again. Between, if this legislation were to take effect between now and the point in time when we would have to go to divest, it could still be six companies, but it could be six entirely different companies. So this isn't a static thing. And that's how we're approaching it from an administrative.
If I might just follow on this real quick, just to reemphasize that last point, we did not put into the cost, into our fiscal note, any opportunity cost of divesting of any company. We're not saying that it's a good investment, a bad investment, we're going to lose money because we're not in it. We took none of that into account. This is strictly the administrative cost of trying to develop a system to screen 3,000 companies through a list of 60 to 80 at our level and at the manager level.
Representative Johnson, you
want to continue? I would like to go back into the commingled funds. I'm assuming that these six companies we invest in, and you guys have a tremendous track record, so I'm assuming that they're profitable or we wouldn't be investing in them. So I would think it would be likely that they are in a commingled fund because of the profitability, and we chose them for a reason, and wouldn't the fund managers also have chosen them for a reason?
Through the chair, different fund managers have different styles, different approaches. I don't know how to answer that. It could very well be that they're in a commingled fund. I'm not sure exactly which managers have them now. And if we have an individual, a separate account, they're held in a separate account at this point. And if that is a similar style to some of our commingled funds, they could very well be there. But we have people buying and selling the same stock on a daily basis in two different accounts. I mean, that is what makes a market.
And thinking, just in wrap up of that, I think the question is, or maybe the answer is, we don't really know, other than the fact that we're not going to take and write a, and I know I'm so oversimplifying, we're not going to write a personal check from the permanent fund to buy this. We still don't know if we're going to have any impact on these six companies because they could be receiving capital from a commingled fund. So we really don't know that we're going to have a positive impact one way or the other.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, we have no effect on the company. The day they sold their stock to the public, whether it was to us or someone else, and we've ultimately bought that stock, they received the value at that point in time. If we sell our stock to the retirement system of Minnesota or we sell it to someone, an individual, here in Juneau, it has no effect on the company.
Their
capital has been raised.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up on that point. Go ahead.
Laura, you mentioned that it's a constantly changing, you know, with the commingled funds. How would you identify if three companies that are not identified decide they're going to start doing business with Sudan? Who's going to identify that and let you know so your managers can, I mean, if this were to pass?
Through the chair, Representative Johansson, the bill directs the board of the permanent fund as well as the board of the pension fund to create a list and to be in charge of its upkeep. Gives us some guidelines on how we would accomplish the research necessary, but doesn't limit us to those guidelines. So we would be responsible for identifying which companies are engaged in the activities in Sudan that are described in this bill, the ones that are believed to directly support the government. And I just would, if it's with the chair's indulgence, I'd like to take an extra moment to really just clarify that the sort of products that we buy, I'm sorry, I apologize, product is a very jargony word. Most of the management firms that the permanent fund hires, we do hire to create a single account that has our name on it, and we hold all those stocks directly. Then there is another type of account that we set up that is a commingled account. We buy into them, other people buy into them. And so that's just kind of a description of how those two different types of investments work. We only have, out of the 47 stock and bond accounts that we have, only two of them are commingled funds.
Thank you.
I have a question. I sat on the ARM board for a little while until I decided to run for office and I had to resign. So one of the challenges that you have in investing is continuing to diversify your portfolio so we don't get stuck in a situation like we were before where we are over-invested in some particular area and then it collapses and we have a tremendous loss of the corpus. When you go out and hire or contract to managers of a different fund, there's a certain, unless this has changed, this is why I'm asking. At the time that I was involved, you contract to those particular money managers. You give them a certain amount, a dollar amount, for which you want them to invest. There are some parameters around what the investments must be. But then they have the latitude to go out and work within those investments to try to maximize the amount of gain that you have. Because dependent upon their ability to be able to continue to be one of your money managers is them being able to produce a reasonable expectation on the return for those investments. And so part of what you're doing at that point is they're charging a certain basis points for managing of those funds. And so their success in continuing to be able to work for the permanent fund is how successful they are in generating a return on their investment. Do those contracts include tracking of these types of investments, or that is that part of where the fiscal note comes, because this would be an additional contract that you would have to go back and purchase from those money managers that don't currently exist?
That's Representative Roses, that's precisely what would happen. They are contracted, whether it's on geography. We have domestic managers, we have international managers, and we have global managers. We have style managers, value and growth. We have capitalization managers, large cap, mid cap, SMID cap, small cap, micro cap, all of those. They're hired to do a specific thing, and as you said, that's their charge. And we have a contract basis points. If we decide to customize, you know, say you can do everything but this or everything but that, we have a whole different feel, our fee arrangement that we'd have to do. You talk about passive funds, which we have a lot of passively invested money. That's very cheap unless you have a customized index. You know, we want someone to manage to the Russell 1000 or you pick an index. But if you say we want you to passively manage to the Russell 1000 except these names, then it's not pure passive, it's a custom passive. So all of those things have costs.
Thank you, and I'll follow up because everybody else has questions as well. There's another level on top of that, and that's the fact that, and I don't know about the permanent fund board, but I do know from the ARM board, we hire consultants whose responsibility it is to go out and monitor the money managers that we have to make sure that they're staying within the framework of what the investment structure was that we selected them for, and to make sure that they're doing the accurate reporting back in terms of what the expectations are. Do you as well have one of those consultants, or, well, in our case, we had three. Do you have multiple consultants that are supposed to be overviewing the investment process for each of those money managers?
Representative Rosas, yes, we do. We have one general consultant who monitors the performance as reported by the individual managers for accuracy. And what you lose, you know, is the ability really to, well, you don't lose entirely, but your ability to criticize a manager when you limit what he can do. If you limit his judgments, then you've limited his ability to perform for what you've hired him for. But that we have taken none of that into the equation. Again, that goes into
that
the loss.
That was my next question. So nowhere in this fiscal note that you prepared does that include the oversight from the consultant to make sure that those money managers are operating within the framework that you have established.
I don't know if we changed anything I think at the consultant level we didn't add any costs in.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, it wouldn't change the functions that Kellen Associates provides for us.
Okay.
Where we did include them was on any potential manager searches. Yeah. Kellen Associates assists us in manager searches,
That's the same consultant we used. Did you want to follow up on that point?
Yes.
We have other questions.
No, it's that point, but a little broader. It seems to me like, Mr. Chairman, it seems to me like that, you know, we've heard some criticism of the fiscal note, and from what I'm hearing, it may be light. If you take in the cost and all the things that you said, we didn't include this, we didn't include this, we didn't include this, sounds to me like that we could be looking at substantially more bottom line.
Through the chair, I think it's been mentioned that at least the people that have looked at this said our exposure today is about $22 million. So, you know, the lost earnings from that probably wouldn't change it much. If you start extrapolating to this list that currently I think is somewhere between 60 and 80, I really don't know the number, or a broader list, you may really have some impact at that point by not being able to, you know, have the full investment world to look to. But we have not, you know, somehow this has been portrayed as we're profiteering off of this, and we're not. These are just administrative costs that would to implement this bill.
Representative Dahl.
Ooh, a lot to all of this. I guess the bottom line, we want to obviously have an impact. I think most people in the state would like to have an impact on the genocide, and they feel that this is the way to do it by divesting. If I understand your testimony correctly, you're saying that this would have very little impact on that.
Through the chair, Representative Dahl, I think that is what I'm saying. If you look, if you've had a chance to look at the report that we gave you on the effect of South African divestiture, in retrospect, people said this had very little effect, if any, on the ending of apartheid. And it's, again, you go back to the fact that once these companies have raised the capital, who owns the share of stock? That's downstream. They don't care if we own it or a fund in Switzerland owns it or it's in my 401k. That's out of their hands. They have raised the capital. And just on the fiscal note, these numbers are large. You have to keep in mind always, everything we do has a lot of zeros involved. I mean, this is a very large fund. You talk about sovereign wealth funds around the world. By most rankings, we're the 12th or 13th largest sovereign wealth fund in the world, and we are kind of the proxy for a U.S. sovereign wealth fund.
Representative Dahl, do you want to continue?
Yeah, just sort of a follow-up on that. So I'm guessing that is there a better way of impacting what happens over there other than through the permanent fund? What are we left with here in terms of your suggestions? I know it's kind of a huge, impossible.
Through the chair, Representative, I don't mean we're just not in the foreign policy business. I'm sure there's a lot of things we can do. I honestly don't think this is very effective.
But you're saying this is not the way of doing it.
Right. Exactly.
Representative Johansson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to kind of pull it out of the details a little bit. In the past, have there been has there been legislation introduced, and have you testified and talked about the fund as a impacted by social, basically social decisions rather than strictly economic decisions?
Through the chair, Representative Johansson, I think there's been several attempts at this type of thing. There was one 2 years ago on state-sponsored terrorism. It was a much broader bill than this. There have been at various times tobacco issues. Whether we should invest in ExxonMobil has come up from time to time, and I'm not sure.
I don't believe, through the chair, Representative Johansson, I don't believe that Exxon has come up as a legislative issue, but there was a bill introduced to divest the permanent fund from South Africa, and it didn't pass.
Well,
we didn't. I was still in middle school, so I didn't testify on that one. To answer the other part of your question, but
thank you for reminding us how old we are.
But we did. We did testify.
I remember too,
just because I was in middle school. We did testify 2 years ago on the resolution that would have encouraged us to divest from
just
Iran.
A quick follow-up.
Please.
I asked the sponsor if he had considered. One of the coast primes, sorry, if he had considered an overall bill addressing the policy of the permanent fund, other than specific things like terrorism or Exxon or this one, have there been bills introduced that would guide you more towards a social investment policy rather than a strictly economic?
I'm not aware of any.
With those, Representative Johansson to the chair, I'm not aware of any either. I think that's been the handful that we've talked about this morning.
Okay. I'd like to be able to try and research that and get more of a understanding of the conversation of that whole idea.
We can.
I'm going to respond to that a little bit from having sat on the ARM board. I remember that one of the attempts that was being made there, and it was through a suggestion, not a piece of legislation, that recommended that we take a look at more environmentally and more socially conscious companies in which to invest. And so we created a fund that would do that, and I'll tell you, that was the most difficult fund to find investments in. It was the most difficult fund to find a money manager for, and it was also the one in which we had the least amount of return. And so that was a very, very difficult piece to deal with. And so trying to get to where you're talking about is there's a tremendous amount of difficulty in it. But Representative, were you through?
Yes, thank you.
Representative Cockell.
And I suppose one of the questions we have to ask ourselves is, have other sovereign wealth funds engaged in the policy that we're being asked to engage in? So you might want to think about that. Probably one of the largest ones would probably be the Norwegian fund, I think, if I remember correctly. And then beyond that, it gets into the Middle East, which we know that has its own issues. So there's three things I think looks like we're asked to consider here. The atrocity of Sudan is absolutely atrocious. I couldn't agree more with those testifying that it is bad to the bone. It is one of the most unfortunate things. And if you look back at the 20th century, we had many incidents of that that would make Sudan look rather small in comparison, I think, which is sad, is very sad. Then, so I think the question asked to my left here was, can we have an impact on that? And it looks like, at best, it would be a minimal impact. And it looks like what we would do, we would use up whatever money that would stop in our own administrative costs. So I don't know that creating a scrutinized company list that would have a direct, indirect, or have holding now or in the future, even the possibility. So what you do is you'd have to scrutinize every company you invested in, basically. And for what? And then the other question is, should we as a legislature use this fund to dictate social policy? And I, for one, don't want to do that. As egregious as that social policy is, it's not my thinking that you intentionally have invested money to propagate genocide. And I would hope that those testifying today do not think that that is ever your intention to invest and profit off of genocide. There are companies that may, but I don't know that we've reached down into their boardrooms to find out their motive on business investment. And so I don't know that we need to reach down into their boardroom to get their motive. And that's the problem, is should we then become that good at designing social policy that we reach down into the motive of a boardroom that we're going to invest in? Or should we look at the funds, the S&Ps, the mid-caps, small-caps? I personally think that this fund should stay out of that social policy. I don't think the legislature should. I think this is a good venue to ask the very questions that these people are asking. Can we do anything through your fund, or should we do something otherwise? And I think the case is very compelling. I probably will not go along with this particular bill, but I would suggest that in our investment, if you see a bell ringer come up, that you pay attention to it. But at the same time, I don't want to reach over the border of the policy call of the legislature into your management style to create a social policy question. So I guess, having said all that then, has it been your experience in other sovereign wealth funds that they have done investment specifically on these social policies?
Representative Coghill, through the chair, two parts to that. Norway, which is substantially larger than ours, has a lot of social issues that they monitor with their fund, but their fund, although it's I guess I'd say comes from the same gene pool as ours, it's a natural resource wealth fund. It has a different use. It funds a lot of their social programs within the country, and it's so they do some of that. One of the things I think when you talk about our fund, as compared to the sovereign wealth funds around the world, there's a study out now that judges, I think, the 36 sovereign wealth funds on two basic issues, which are very important at the national level and the international level. Because people, as you see these investments that the sovereign wealth funds are making, it's why are they making them? Are these political investments? Are these economic investments? And secondly, the other method is how transparent are these funds? And they have the traditional, quadrant chart. Alaska, Alberta, and Norway are the models of transparency and economic investment. And, how the rest of the world, the Middle Eastern wealth funds, China, can be brought to the model that this fund has as far as transparency and making economic investments is where some of the international organizations are trying to migrate the sovereign wealth fund. So, you should be very proud of how we fit into that as that model.
Representative Cockfield, you want to?
Mr. Chairman, he brings up a good point. I think the blindness with which we put on this as an economic policy is kind of important. I suppose if you really wanted to make a comparison, it would be like making profit by using the Internet when we know that many people are violated by the Internet, both in their identities and through a variety of different very, very bad activities. And whether we as a state would ever quit using the Internet because slavery is somehow managed through that venue. So I'm trying to put a comparison as to why I don't know that I would want to start using our sovereign wealth fund, if you will, as a tool to change social policy. But I think governments should be tools to change social policy. I have argued many bills in this very committee room on that very issue. And so I don't think that it's improper that we even be having this discussion. But I don't know that I would want to make the policy call of using that fund to have to scrutinize down to the detail that we've even described in this bill. I haven't been convinced yet, although I have been convinced of the magnitude of the atrocity. It's just It's mind-boggling. It's heart-wrenching. So those are the two things that I'm trying to put in comparison. So I'm very sympathetic with those who came out and testified on that issue, but I just don't know that I want to use this tool for that.
If I might just that's exactly the word, Mr. Chair, that I was going to conclude with. Or, you know, the mission is incredibly just. I honestly do not feel this is the right tool. This corporation and this fund is not the right tool to write it.
Any other questions for the committee members for either Laura or Michael? Seeing none, we have one more person to testify. Brian Andrews from the Department of Revenue. You get to hit cleanup.
My dad called.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sure you've read that.
Mr. Chairman, fellow members of the State Affairs Committee, for the record, my name is Brian Andrews. I'm with the Department of Revenue, and I'm responsible for the Treasury portion of the Department of Revenue. You know, I've got about 15 minutes of testimony here, but I think because it's long and
it's a good thing you said that, because you're not only going to get but about three.
That's right. So let me just abbreviate everything and say that I very much agree with what Mr. Burns had to say in his testimony. But there are a couple things that I would like to point out from the pension fund side. And that is in an article that was in Pension and Investments, dated 3/5/07. The article goes to say that the law requiring the Sudan divestiture passed in Illinois has cost the $39 billion teachers' retirement system of the state of Illinois an estimated $2.1 million. So far in lost earnings, including transaction costs and the cost, the Illinois State Board of Investments, more than $850,000. The real question is, who will make up this difference to the employees and the citizens of that state? On February 23, 2007, Judge Matthew Keneally of the U.S. District Court in Chicago overturned the Illinois law that ordered funds in that state to divest. He wrote in his decision, and I quote, "First, the restrictions on pension funds' ability to invest in many equities and mutual funds unquestionably constitutes irreparable injury. Second, the plaintiffs have no adequate remedy at law. Defendants are state officials who have sovereign immunity from suits for damages," and then it goes on. But let me just simply say that currently the state's Alaska's pension plans are underfunded by $8.6 billion. Any additional expense or loss of investment performance is only going to increase that number, leading to even higher annual contribution rates. Let me remind you that the average contribution rate to PERS is currently 35.2%, and that to TERS of 44.2%. It is difficult to determine what the overall cost impact of divestiture will be to the retirement systems, but suffice to say it will be tangible and significant cost to implementing and monitoring such a directive. We have estimated that it will cost approximately $3 million to implement and monitor, and that doesn't even take into consideration underperformance and the increased volatility to the portfolios. Let me just conclude by saying all of us here sincerely wish to help the afflicted of Sudan and help bring an end to this conflict. Unfortunately, I do not believe that this bill will have an impact towards that end. I urge you to carefully consider the tangible and intangible economic impacts that this legislation would have on the state's pension plans and the far-reaching potential detrimental long-term effects on its participants. The legislation is well-intended, and the desire to make a difference is noble, but mixing moral and political agendas at the expense of our citizens' financial security is not a good combination. And with that, I'll be happy to entertain any questions.
Any questions? Representative Dahl.
I understand all the points made to this point up to now, but what would be the impact of that $10 million on on what we receive as our permanent fund? I understand it would be about $9. Can you give me some kind of an estimate?
That would be a question through the chair, Representative Dahl. That would be a question for Mike Burns. I only represent the pension plans.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and we haven't even touched on this today. I'm wondering about the fiduciary responsibility that you have as a manager and as the permanent fund has, are we running afoul of what our charge is if we go in this direction? I mean, are we? I just have some concerns. You'd mentioned that a judge overturned it in Illinois based upon, you know, some very clear legal principles, and I'm wondering if we're putting our fund managers and the purse-ters people in a position where they are actually violating their fiduciary responsibilities by mandating this.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, very good question that I don't have an answer for, but certainly that whole question of fiduciary responsibility and investing under the prudent investor rule would need some interpretation from Department of Law or from the legal community.
I would certainly like an answer to that, Mr. Chairman. I think that's a key issue to this, if what we're doing is even legal.
You should get an opinion on that. Any further question that you have?
No, sir. Thank you.
I have one. You heard me a couple of different times mention the ARM board and some of the situations that occurred there. Were you listening to the testimony that I gave? And if so, did I misstate anything? I wanted to make sure that people don't think that I misstated anything about what the investment strategies were and how we did it and some of the funds that we worked on. Was there anything that you needed to clarify that I said?
Mr. Chairman, could you refresh my memory? I had to step out of the room for a few minutes.
You probably weren't here, so the answer is you don't know.
I don't know.
I'm sure you were perfectly accurate.
I try to be, but that's just clarification. Any other questions from the committee? Okay, at this point, I am going to close public testimony on House Bill 287. We are at about 10 minutes to 2, and I will tell you right now that the prime sponsor for this bill, who is also the chair of this committee, had asked me to please hold this bill because he had some things that he wanted to say, and it certainly sounds like there's some information that other committee members have requested. And so with that, I want to make a statement that our next State Affairs meeting is going to be Tuesday, February the 12th at 8 a.m., and we are going to take up House Bill 259, which is establishing Alaska State History Week in Alaska, and also confirmation hearings on the State Commission for Human Rights, the Personnel Board, and the Alaska Public Offices Commission. So with that being said, unless there's any other pressing issues any committee member have, I am going to adjourn the State Affairs meeting for today, and thank you very much.